Hello, I'm Tom Rollins, president of the Teaching Company. These lectures are part of the Great Courses on Tape series. The Great Courses on Tape cover a broad array of university-level disciplines. The lectures in each course are either 30 or 45 minutes long. By listening for less than an hour a day, you can finish even the longest course in just weeks. Browse our catalog or website and imagine how much you could learn if you spent just 30 minutes a day for the next year in the best college classrooms in the world. The lecturers are university professors carefully selected by the teaching company and its customers for intellectual distinction and teaching excellence. The lectures on these tapes are titled From Plato to Postmodernism, Understanding the Essence of Literature and the Role of the Author. The lecturer is Professor Louis Marcos. Professor Marcos specializes in British Romantic poetry, literary theory, and the classics. He received his B.A. in English and History from Colgate University and earned his master's degree and Ph.D. in English from the University of Michigan. He is a member of Phi Beta Kappa and has gone on to win teaching awards at both the University of Michigan and at Houston Baptist University, where he has taught since 1991. Each of Dr. Marcos' lectures is outlined in the course guide that comes with these tapes. The course guide also includes a glossary, timeline, biographical notes, and bibliography. You may find it useful to review the outlines before and after listening to the lectures. Lecture 13, Wordsworth, Coleridge, and British Romanticism.
With Lecture 13, we move into a new unit, British Romanticism. After a brief introduction to the period that will contrast the Romantics with the century that preceded them, we shall move on to analyze the great poetic, theoretical experiment that most consider the urtext of British Romanticism, lyrical ballads. We shall explore both the unique plan of lyrical ballads and the implications of that plan for literary theory. All right, in this unit, Unit 4, we shall consider the contributions of the British Romantic poets. Our text will be Wordsworth's preface to the lyrical ballads, Coleridge's Biographia Literaria, Shelley's Defense of Poetry, and Keats's Letters. After an initial lecture on lyrical ballads itself, that's this lecture, we shall then devote one lecture each to Wordsworth, Coleridge, and Shelley. Rather than devote an entire lecture to Keats, what I will do is consider Keats's theories in relation to those of Wordsworth, Coleridge, and Shelley, so he will be fitted in the additional lectures. All right, let's talk about the Romantics in general now. Like Pope and Dryden, all four of our theorists in this unit, again, Wordsworth, Coleridge, Shelley, and Keats, were poets before they were critics. And thus, their theory is a reflection of their own poetic technique. In other words, they're not like the last unit we did. Those were philosopher critics, Hegel and Kant particularly. Schiller was actually a great poet. But our four Romantics are more like Pope and Dryden because, again, they were poets. And when they wrote their criticism, they were writing it, again, out of their own experience. So it gives a little more, perhaps, practicality or pragmatic touches to their theory. Now, there's a difference, though. They're like Pope and Dryden in the sense that they're poets. However, there's a big difference. The Romantics treated the poet rather than nature or the rules of decorum as the source and touchstone of art. When we looked at Pope and Dryden, especially Pope, we noticed that they were theorists who were very interested in nature and decorum and following those rules. In this lecture, we're going to see our poet critics following the idea of the poet. In addition, we're going to find that all of our poets fashion, a new social role for the poet, very different from the 18th century. All right, another introductory matter. We should notice that all four of our Romantics altered the epistemological theories of the Germans, in other words, what we looked at in our last unit. Now, they are epistemologists, but there's a difference. Whereas the German epistemologists were still pragmatic theorists, and you remember, interested in the relationship between the poem and the audience, The British Romantics were what we might call expressive epistemologists. And you'll remember expressive theorists are interested in the relationship between the poem and the poet. Another difference, whereas the theorists of the last unit betray an 18th century or Enlightenment orientation, and that was particularly true in the case of Burke and Kant. Remember I said they're proto-romantics or pre-romantics, but they're still very much 18th century Enlightenment interested in reason and analysis. The romantics often define themselves in opposition to the age of reason. They borrow some ideas from it, but basically they are a kind of a revolution, a reaction against what was going on in the century before. And that's actually fairly typical in all areas of intellectual history. Now, though they're still interested in mental faculties, epistemology, they replace the 18th century emphasis on analysis with a new focus on synthesis. And in addition, they privilege imagination over reason and judgment. And of course, we talked about that in detail in the last unit. Now, you'll remember I said with Schiller and Hegel, we're already moving in that direction. And I should say now, to be clear, I did break chronology last unit. I just should tell you that Hegel really comes after the British Romantics. But to get some consistency, I put him with the Germans. But he really comes after the Romantics. All right, before moving on to lyrical ballads, I want to survey one more thing. There are three competing events for the cause or origin of Romanticism that I just want to run through quickly. Three possible origins for Romanticism. The first possible origin is the publication of Rousseau's Confessions in 1781 with its championing of the individual and its radical notion that the personal life and ideas of a single individual is matter worthy of great art. The great Jean-Jacques Rousseau, although he lived and died in the 18th century, really is one of the great origins of Romanticism. He was one of the first people to dare to write an autobiography. Now, you all know there's a famous autobiography by Augustine called The Confessions, but I want you to think about it. The only reason Augustine could justify writing an entire book about himself is that his autobiography is really what Christians call a testimony. In other words, it's there to give glory to God. I was a sinner, now I'm a saved Christian. Jean-Jacques Rousseau makes no excuses. He is writing an autobiography because he thinks that he himself is matter worthy of great literature. That is a radically new idea, that you could spend a whole book writing about yourself. And Jean-Jacques Rousseau actually delights in his individuality. He says, "I am unique. No one else is like me. When they made me, they broke the mold." This is a radical, romantic notion that says the individual, rather than society or God or anything else, should be at the center. So that's one of the origins or causes of Romanticism. The second one that is often discussed is the beginning of the French Revolution, the storming of the Bastille in 1789. And that event not only offered the hope of both internal and external freedom, but promised more radically that internal dreams could affect and even alter the external world. In other words, the French Revolution not only showed that we can throw off our chains, that we can change the world, but what it showed more radically is that an internal vision that people have, a vision of freedom, that they can take that internal vision and project it onto the world and change the world in accordance with their dreams. That's very romantic, as you'll see in this unit. Finally, the third origin, and that is what we are most interested in this lecture and in this unit, is the publication of Lyrical Ballads in 1798 and what it was followed with. In 1800, there was a second edition of Lyrical Ballads to which Wordsworth added a preface. Now, in this lecture, we're going to look just at Lyrical Ballads 1798. In the next lecture, we will look at the preface itself, because the preface, in some ways, really caused the revolution even more than Lyrical Ballads. But we're going to split them up. Now, why is Lyrical Ballads a third source? Because it championed new subjects for poetry and a new approach to those subjects. And that changed literary theory, really, forever. And that's what I want to do in this lecture, is show you how Lyrical Ballads did that. All right, Wordsworth and Coleridge planned together Lyrical Ballads, and they wanted to make it a new kind of poetic volume. Now, as some of you may know already, The friendship between Wordsworth and Coleridge is one of the most wonderful in all of literary theory. I would say that it was one of the most artistically stimulating friendships, perhaps of all time. It was unique, and the two men really played off each other and helped each other in terms of strengths and weaknesses, and together did some great things. Again, it was a wonderful friendship, and it was very fruitful in terms of poetry and theory. Now, the origin of lyrical ballads, Wordsworth tells us about it a little bit in his preface. But if you want to really learn the origin of lyrical ballads, you want to read chapter 14 of Coleridge's Biographia Literaria. That is his autobiography. If you want to follow it, it's wonderful reading. It's actually excerpted in Critical Theory since Plato. All right. In 1797, Wordsworth and Coleridge were neighbors in the beautiful Lake District in the northern part of England. And they would spend lots of days discussing and talking about poetry and life. And they would do what British people up there love to do, take long walks along the beautiful grass they have in England. And they would walk and they would talk and they'd let their mind run free. And out of these conversations, they conceived the idea of composing a series of poems of two distinct but complementary kinds. And neither one of them remembered who first came up with the idea, but they said, hey, let's do something new. We're both going to write different kinds of poems, but they will complement each other in a special way. And I want to tell you now the two different kinds of poems they wanted to write and how they complemented. Now, the former kind of poem, which Wordsworth would end up writing, would select its objects from nature, from the common, mundane, everyday world of the countryside and its inhabitants. In short, these poems would focus on things that are so familiar that we often overlook them, things whose very commonness renders them invisible. In other words, everyday things, things from nature, the rustic farmers that lived in the Lake District, not rich people, not aristocrats, but common everyday things, not only common people, but common objects of nature. That would be the source or object of the poetry. However, this is what makes it unique. Rather than merely copy or record these things in a straight mimetic fashion, rather than just, you know, describing the object, the poet would throw over them an imaginative coloring that would allow his readers to see them afresh. In other words, the trouble with everyday things is that we see them so often, we take them for granted. We don't even notice them anymore. They lose their mystery and their wonder. We've got a cliche, kind of a tired cliche, to stop and smell the roses. Here we might say we need to stop and see the roses. We miss the mystery of it. The best example of this comes from painting. The great romantic painter Vincent van Gogh. I think you've all seen some of his pictures of sunflowers. There are some pictures of flowers over here if you want to look. But in his sunflower, we've all seen sunflowers before. But believe me, the first time you see this painting or any of his paintings of flowers, you think to yourself, my God, I've never seen a sunflower before. I missed something all along. Well, the same thing Van Gogh does in his painting is what Wordsworth is going to do in his poems. By lending these objects, these things, these common things, a charm of novelty, the poet wants to evoke a sense of childlike wonder in his reader, a feeling more often associated with the supernatural than with the natural. Again, he wants us to see it afresh, as if we've never seen it before. The way a child sees the world. You know, every time a child sees the moon in the evening, it's a whole new experience. It's beautiful. It's excited. They grab their parents and they tug. Look up there. Isn't that magical? Well, that's what Wordsworth wants to restore in us. Not childish, but childlike. Now, this process by which the veil of familiarity is suddenly mystically ripped away from everyday objects is known as defamiliarization. Now, what do I mean by the veil of familiarity? We all can understand the veil of mystery. There are certain mysteries like death, which we can't fully pierce through because they're a veil, a mystery. But the veil of familiarity means that, again, when something becomes so familiar, we see it every day, we don't see it anymore, and so it's as if a veil has covered it. We're missing it. We're not seeing it. Defamiliarization means suddenly, through poetry, our familiarity is ripped away, and again, we're forced to look at it as if for the first time. Most men, Coleridge says, are like what God says of the Jews in Isaiah 6, We have eyes, but we do not see. Some of you remember, they have eyes, but do not see, ears, but do not hear. They're like their idols. Well, a lot of times that happens to us. We see it, but we don't really see it. Defamiliarization opens our eyes to the wonders around us. It is apocalyptic. It rips away the veil or the covering to allow us to see the true mystery that lurks behind. Now, as I've said, Wordsworth was responsible for this portion of lyrical ballads, and he composed a series of poems centered around such humble, rustic characters as Simon Lee, Goody Blake, and the Idiot Boy. Believe it or not, those are the titles of some of his poems. They're very common, rustic people, not the kind of people that an 18th century poet would think worthy of writing any kind of serious poem about. Very simple, rustic characters, usually illiterate or barely literate, but despite their commonness, Wordsworth's poems infuse them with dignity, power, and mystery. Romanticism is much more democratic. It sees the dignity in the common. 18th century, again, look towards the aristocratic, towards the refined. So that's what Wordsworth does in his portion of lyrical ballads. One way to put it is he takes natural objects and makes them seem almost supernatural. All right, the latter kind of poem that Coleridge did would select its object from the realm of the supernatural. Let's go the other way. Wordsworth takes the natural and makes it supernatural. Well, what Coleridge does is go the opposite way. Coleridge takes the supernatural, and the poem that you all are familiar with is The Rime of the Ancient Mariner. That's Coleridge's main contribution to lyrical ballads, and it is a poem richly suffused with supernatural characters and events. It's a magical, mysterious sea journey that, again, it takes place in this world, but it's really in another world. It's a place of mystery, something out of the Arabian Nights or something. However, just as Wordsworth presents his natural objects in such a way as to stimulate an almost supernatural response, so Coleridge presents his supernatural world in such a way as to render it almost natural. That's what I mean when I say they're complementary, as opposed to simply opposites. Now, Coleridge accomplished this poetic feat by uncovering behind the supernatural veil of his tale dramatic and emotional truths. In other words, yes, the story of the mariner is supernatural. It's not really part of our world, finally. But the dramatic and emotional truths, what's going on in his psyche as he goes through this journey, are real. They're realistic, and we can identify with them, and they do seem very real and natural. And our recognition of the psychological truth of the mariner's journey compels us to give to the poem our willing suspension of disbelief. I'll bet many of you have heard that phrase before. This famous Coleridgean phrase signifies our ability to temporarily suspend the claims of reason and logic and to enter, through the power of the sympathetic imagination, into the life and heart of the poem. In other words, he writes it in such a way that he gets us as readers to say, all right, I know this is not real, I know it's a fantasy, but I'm going to forget about that now, or I'm going to suspend that, and I am going to move into the poem. Sympathetic imagination, because I am going to move towards the poem as when we're in sympathy with a person, we move towards that person. So we are going to allow ourselves to just accept the poem as true. Because, in fact, dramatically and psychologically, it is. So we're going to suspend all that logical, mathematical side of ourselves and just enter into the world that Coleridge creates. Now, another aspect of this, Coleridge tells us that to inspire in its readers this moment of what he calls poetic faith, the poem must invite them into a higher realm of illusion rather than merely delude them with fanciful images and events. Distinction between illusion and delusion. Illusion is when we are pulled into it and we say, ah, what a beautiful world. It's not real, and yet it is real. It's an illusion, like the illusion of the stage. Delusion is when we suddenly feel like we're being manipulated and fooled. The best way I can give you the distinction is to distinguish in terms of movies. The best example of illusion would be the Star Wars films. Three of them, now four of them. They take us away to, right, a long time ago in a galaxy far, far away. Now, those movies are totally fantasy, but we buy into their illusion because they're so real. The relationships and whatnot going on seem so real to us that we move into those movies and accept them. Delusion, an example of that would be those horrendous Batman movies. I don't know if any of you even bothered to see those, but those movies are so phony, you feel manipulated and deluded, and maybe some teenagers buy it, but I certainly don't buy those worlds as real. I don't really think the director believes in it, and therefore I don't believe in it. I feel deluded, and so I sit there and watch, and maybe I'm entertained by special effects, but I'm not moved on any emotional level, as I would be in Star Wars or other good movies. I should say, by the way, that in general, Lucas and Spielberg are probably our great movie directors of illusion. In so many of their movies, they pull us right into a new world and get us to join them. Walt Disney, too, would be experts at illusion. All right, now that you've got the idea of the basic plan, let me tell you about the implications of lyrical ballads for the history of literary theory. Why is it so important? Why is it central? Well, Wordsworth and Coleridge's plan for lyrical ballads calls for a new kind of mimesis that, rather than simply imitate or even perfect its object, transforms it into something rich and strange. That is to say, nature or supernature is merely the occasion for the poem. The poetic act itself, the transformation, is the real point. In other words, the point of the poems in lyrical ballads, the point is not the object itself. It's not merely to record the object. I mean, that's interesting and important, but that's not the key function of the poem. What the poem is really, quote, about is what Wordsworth or Coleridge do with that object, how they transform it through their poetic imagination. They change it into something new. That's what it's about. It's about the poetic process rather than about the object. It's about the subject, then, if you will. That's the importance of epistemology. In other words, it is not the rules of decorum that control the art, but the imaginative vision of the poet that determines the shape and end of the poem. And that's why expressive theories are interested in the relationship between the poem and the poet, because it's the poet's perceptive powers that determine what the poem is going to be like. Even more radically, the plan of lyrical ballads carries out a supreme form of epistemology in which objects or things take their ultimate nature not from what they are, but from how they are perceived by the poet. This is radical. It is epistemology. Perception's important. But now, really, the object is not even important at all. Now, the way we perceive the object is what it becomes. The object now is a mix of what it is and what we make it. Very interesting. Now, let me explain this. In this, Wordsworth and Coleridge, I believe, were certainly influenced, even more than by the Germans, by a great poet, William Blake, and his masterpiece, The Songs of Innocence and Experience. In this work, Blake demonstrates how the same images and events take on a different coloring, form, and reality when viewed through the eyes of innocence and experience. The subtitle of his work, Shewing the Two Contrary States of the Human Soul, captures perfectly the radical romantic belief that things are as they are perceived, and that we half create the world around us. Let me explain more. In the Songs of Innocence and Experience, there are two volumes of poetry, but they're meant to be linked together. And oftentimes, there will be a poem in the Songs of Innocence that has a parallel in the Songs of Experience. For instance, there are two poems called The Chimney Sweeper, one in Innocence, one in Experience. They're both about the horrible reality of these little boys that were forced to clean chimneys. It was a terrible job. It was social manipulation. Most of them died young from all kinds of cancer, horrible diseases. But in the world of Innocence, even though there is horrible exploitation, the focus of that poem is innocence. It's how the childlike innocence and faith can rise above the horrors of social exploitation. In the version in Experience, though, all we see is the exploitation and manipulation. In other words, the world, the reality, the event is exactly the same, but because the perceptive point of view in each poem is different, it makes everything else different. So things are not as they are, but as they are perceived. We create the world around us. Now let me give you the easier example, the example I always give to my undergrads. Whenever I try to explain this, I always choose two unsuspecting girls in my class and I use them as guinea pigs. I say, all right, Jane and Mary, let me tell you a story. Two of you are now in Houston. It's about 9 o'clock in the evening and you're about to walk out and go home and it's raining. Same exact setting. But there's a different background to this. Jane, just before you walk out that door to go home in the rainstorm, your boyfriend of many years has just proposed to you. And you're excited because you've been waiting for this. It's a beautiful ring. And you are just on top of the world. Mary, on the other hand, before you walk out into the rainstorm, your boyfriend of 4 years has just broken up with you in the nastiest, most doggish kind of way. And you are just horrified by this. All right. You're both walking into the rainstorm. Now, I want you each to write a poem about the rain. Same rain, same time of day, same place. Well, I'm sure their poems would be very different. Jane's poem would probably describe the rainstorm as cleansing, purifying. She might talk about Gene Kelly singing in the rain. Everything's beautiful. The world is fresh and new and reborn every morning, right? Like morning has broken. What's Mary's poem going to be like? How is she going to describe the rain? Dark, oppressive. It's going to feel, every raindrop is going to feel like a knife in her back. Now, what are we saying here? It's the exact same rain. It's the same rainstorm. Shouldn't their poems be the same? No. Why are their poems different? Because each of them is working out of a different perceptive mood. The state of their soul is different. Jane is in a state of innocence. Mary is in a state of experience, a more cynical state. And so the world that they see, the rainstorm, is now going to be colored by what's going on in their soul. Another example, whenever you're mad, we always say that you're seeing what? Seeing red. It's as if everything you see is covered by the color red, right? That is what it means. Things are as they are perceived. I like to call this the externalization of the internal. Because what happens is you take something that's inside you and you externalize it or project it onto the world. Now this concept, the externalization of the internal, things are as they are perceived, lies behind the romantic faith that, to quote Blake, if the doors of perception were cleansed, everything would appear as it is. Infinite. That's something that Blake says, and Blake was most radical in this idea. In other words, if we could just see it right, everything would be beautiful. Now, I should say that this romantic thing has a dark side to it, because it very easily can fall into what I like to call the abyss of solipsism. Now, what is solipsism? Solipsism is the belief that really the whole world is a projection of you. Kind of like a child that's autistic. They live in their own little world. It's as if the world is the way they see it. Or when a child plays peekaboo, right? They cover their eyes and they figure if they can't see you, you can't see them. That egocentrism. I mean, it's very dangerous to fall into this solipsism where you think that, again, the world doesn't really exist. The world is a reflection of you. Many people don't know this, but the religion of Christian Science. Now, most Christian scientists, I don't think, really follow this. Most of them are just like regular Christians. But the real doctrine of Christian Science is actually a little bit more Eastern than Western, because pure Christian Science, Mary Baker Eddy, what she believed is that disease is not really a physical thing. It's bad perception. And so if we can just think of ourselves as well, we'll be well, because sin, even sin and disease and evil are just bad perception. We don't see the world right, which is almost kind of a Hindu concept. Again, I think most Christian scientists probably don't really follow that. They probably are more like regular Christians. But interestingly, this system is very close to Blake. This idea that you can change the world by the way you perceive it. Now, this new, more radical epistemology places the poet and his perceptions at the center of literary theory. Poetry is now to be regarded as self-expression, as a journal of the unique perceptions of an individual. See, now what poetry really is self-expression. It's what's inside of here that's coming out. And so now when we read a poem, what we want to learn about is the poet and his unique perceptions of the world. All right, one more thing that lyrical ballads change. Lyrical ballads shifted old 18th century notions of decorum that declared certain subjects unfit for serious poetry. You'll remember that for the neoclassicists, and also really the classicists, poetry should be written about serious people, aristocrats, kings, knights, princes, all of that stuff. Well, the rustics treated by Wordsworth would have been subjects for comedy in the 18th century. Wordsworth, though, ennobles them to tragic heights. You see, nobody in the 18th century would write a serious, tragic poem about Goody Blake or the Idiot Boy. They might write a comedy about that, but not something serious. This is a big change in the subjects for poetry. Lyrical ballads also breaks with the neoclassical world by mixing the realms of the real and the ideal. Indeed, it often sees the ideal in the real, the supernatural in the natural, and vice versa. In other words, a break in decorum. We're mixing things. We shouldn't be mixing real and ideal, supernatural and natural. We should keep those things separate. Wordsworth and Coleridge have no problem breaking decorum. That's one of the aspects of Romanticism. Finally, not only does lyrical ballads often take children as its subject, it privileges their naive sense of wonder, their freshness and innocence over the refined urbanity and studied wit of the 18th century. Let's move away from this elitist idea, this idea of refinement and urbanity. The whole city court life of the 18th century is in many ways rejected by the Romantics. They want to move to a new way of seeing the world. Again, not childish, but childlike. They want to see the world afresh and with wonder like a child does. And again, that is a big break from the 18th century, which to the Romantics was artificial and unnatural. All right, in our next lecture, we will move on and look at Wordsworth's preface to Lyrical Ballads.